From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not often that leaders from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints hold a public news conference, so people took note last week when the word got out. And sure enough, the leaders got national attention when they announced the church would be supporting legislation to protect the LGBT community from discrimination. But these church officials also claimed a right to be included in these laws. They made a case that the religious freedom rights of people who oppose same-sex marriage are being violated. Today in the program, we're exploring the questions at the heart of the church's position. Is religious freedom, in fact, at risk? And do you have a right to refuse service to someone because of your religious principles? And when you're working all of this out, where do you draw a line? And where do you look for wiggle room or compromise? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There were two significant themes in the public news conference of Mormon church leaders last week. The headline grabber was the announcement that the church would support LGBT non-discrimination laws, like the one particular law that has failed to pass in the state legislature for going on 3 years now, maybe 4 years. Other lawmakers have tried to pass a law like this for 9 years. And most agree the announcement was significant and an important evolution in the church's public stance on gay rights, even if officials stopped short of changing their official position on being opposed to same-sex marriage. And that's what leads to the other theme of the news conference. Leaders like Elder Dallin Oaks said that opponents to same-sex marriage are being sued and sanctioned and ostracized for their religious beliefs. And he called for laws to protect faith communities against this kind of retaliation. So today in the program, we're going to focus on that part of the church's announcement, the religious freedom part. We'll explore the boundaries of religious freedom in this context and ask, what would these kinds of laws look like? How would they work? And where do you compromise? And where do you draw the line? Joining us throughout the program is William Duncan. He is the director of the Center for Family and Society. It's part of the Utah-based conservative think tank Sutherland Institute. He also directs the Independent Marriage Law Foundation. He's joining us today from the studios of KBYU in Provo. And William Duncan, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Nice to be with you again.
Clifford Roski is back with us also, law professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, where he teaches courses on constitutional law, criminal law, and family law. We should also say he's chairman of the Board of Equality Utah. And Professor, welcome back to you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We also have with us today Robin Fretwell Wilson, a professor of law at the University of Illinois, where she directs the program in family law and policy. She's co-editor of the book Same-Sex Marriage and Religious Liberty, Emerging Conflicts, written a number of scholarly articles on the topic, and she's joining us today from her office in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And Professor Wilson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I guess, Clifford Roski, let me put this question to you, although I want to hear from all of you on this. And I want to kind of dispense with this, but we do have to get to the question that has been raised, of course, about the motivation of the LDS Church, the motives that they have for doing this. There have been suggestions that the church, of course, is less interested in equal rights for LGBT individuals as protecting or burnishing their own right to continue this practice of restricting rights. How are you, Cliff Roski, you first, how are you, I guess, assessing that question?
Well, I always assume that anyone who enters a public debate does so in good faith, and I certainly have always assumed that about the LDS Church. I have no reason to believe that they're acting in bad faith in this conversation, and I'm glad that they've joined it. I think that, you know, the good news here is that I do think we can have it both ways. We can have it all, that the conflict between civil rights and religious liberties is overstated and misunderstood. But I also think that we have to be careful. And if we're not careful, we could jeopardize our country's civil rights laws and indeed religious freedom itself. But I'm sure that those are values that we all share together.
William Duncan, the editorial page editor of the New York Times, Andrew Rosenthal, he wrote this in response to the press conference, the news conference last week. He said that what Mormon leaders want is, quote, legal permission to use their religion as an excuse to discriminate. How are you reacting to that?
Well, obviously, I don't agree with that. That seems to be the most strained kind of reading you could have of the statement, which, like Professor Roski, I think was offered in good faith. I think there are, you know, significant questions about what we mean when we talk about discrimination. I think that's probably a little bit of example here of someone talking past the other person and not understanding. That there are good faith disagreements about differences between discrimination on the one hand, which could be understood in a certain way, and facilitating conducts or arrangements that a church can't do because of its religious beliefs, which I think many people would consider to be a separate question. I think that the New York Times statement or the statement by that editor there probably conflates the two and as a result doesn't add to the dialogue but actually probably keeps it from moving forward.
Robin Fretwell Wilson, let me ask you, the church's position is based on this presumption, at least it seems to me, that a growing sense of the secular in this country is now eclipsing religious sensibilities and that it's directly or in some cases indirectly, you know, threatening religious liberty. Is that even true? Before we get to the particulars of how it might be threatening it, is America somehow becoming less devout or less believing? I mean, is that a presumption we can even give here?
Well, that's a hard question. Thank you. I think that may miss the point to some extent. I think what we're really seeing, if you mean by secular, is what I believe is a good movement to recognize the needs of gay and lesbians to have equal access to housing and hiring and employment and public accommodations. That's a good thing. But some of that comes from laws that were put in place in 21 states, not in 29 others, including Utah, unless you look at municipal ordinances, but laws that were put in place to help lesbian and gays with these sorely needed rights. But unfortunately, what happens after a world in which we have marriage equality is sometimes those same non-discrimination statutes spill over to things that I think most people would see as deeply religious, as religious sacraments like the wedding ceremony. And those laws were designed to allow, basically to deal with racial discrimination and other things way back. So that a person could drive from Mississippi to New York and be able to stay at a hotel and get a meal. But now they're being sort of pulled over, I think, in unintended ways to things like facilitating another person's marriage, even though that marriage might be religiously freighted for the person asked to facilitate it. So I think it's our changing cultural norms and things that folks are being asked to do, combined with laws that were really designed for burgers and taxis and large commercial apartment buildings, then kind of coming together to push on whether somebody has a duty to facilitate another person's marriage.
Let me get to the what seems like the really critical question. Elder Oaks said last week at the news conference that there has been, and I'm going to quote him here, a steady erosion of treasured freedoms that are guaranteed in the United States Constitution. And he went through some actual specifics here, and I wanted to mention just a few. He mentioned a particular case in Houston where government lawyers had their sermons and notes, where government lawyers actually subpoenaed the sermons and notes of some pastors who had opposed a particular law on religious grounds. That disturbed him. The more sort of high-profile cases and more well-known, at least around here, regard, and Elder Oaks cited this, an Olympic gold medalist, a man by the name of Peter Vidmar, who was pressured to resign from an Olympic Games delegation because of his support of the anti-gay marriage Proposition 8 in California. He also mentioned Brendan Eich, who was forced to resign from his position as CEO of Mozilla in California, therefore the same reason. So he mentioned some particulars. Cliff Roske, does he have a point? Is religious freedom, based on these examples he's mentioning, in fact, at stake?
I do think that it's worth talking about what religious freedom includes and what it can't include, right? We all agree that we need the freedom to practice our faith without fearing being thrown in jail or fired from our jobs or evicted from our homes or denied services based on our religion or our religious beliefs or the notion that someone thinks we're a sinner, you know. But, of course, to take that principle more broadly and to kind of turn it around, as we fear some folks are doing, if an employer could fire you based on the employer's religious beliefs, then, of course, all the employees no longer have those religious freedoms. The same applies for landlords and business owners. So every freedom is, you know, has its limits, and I think that that's a very clear limit on the principle of religious freedom.
But William Duncan, what do you think? I mean, he mentioned are these particular cases where they're crossing over a line and eroding, you know, constitutional guarantees of freedom of religion? Or is this just the consequences of their support of things that may not be popular?
Well, I suspect that there's some of both in the sense that, you know, clearly these issues are controversial, and there will be, you know, some of the examples given relate to kind of more cultural things, you know, pressure, boycotts, and that sort of thing. And then some actually reflect actions by government. And I think that we do see that there has been, in some ways, an eclipsing of this. What I think we had developed in the 20th century, at least, into reasonably robust protection of the ability of most people to act on their religious beliefs in the public square, with obvious exceptions, as Elder Oak specifically mentions, the idea of health and safety issues. And some of that, I think there's a converging stream of three elements that the law has changed, shifted in some ways towards a principle of not wanting to I'm thinking of a specific case where the U.S. Supreme Court said that as long as a law had a neutral applicability, meaning everybody was affected by it, the fact that it had the effect of impinging on religious liberty of others, that was okay. That was not a problem. Then when you combine that with changing cultural attitudes about things like marriage and sexual morality and all of those issues, and then add perhaps what you mentioned earlier, just some perhaps a little bit more hostility towards accommodations of religious people when we don't understand or perhaps agree with or appreciate their views. All of those things coming together have created a situation where I think there are valid reasons to be concerned that the way we would have understood religious liberty and not just religious liberty, of course, because some of those examples where a person is fired for taking a position on a political issue would go right to the core of other kinds of First Amendment considerations, speech and the ability to associate with others on political matters. So I think the concern is valid and worth talking about, and would be, you know, obviously it's great that that we're having that debate nationally now. One of the things I think that was really valuable about the church's statement was their clarification of precisely what they're thinking about in terms of what religious liberty means and how broadly that could be understood.
I want to get to those particulars because I think that's important to really sort of move past the broad subject and get to the particulars. But I guess, Professor Wilson, to that broader question, do you in fact think that there is a point here to be made that religious freedom is at stake, given the cases that Elder Oaks has mentioned?
Well, I think Bill is right to key in on the differences between what private individuals are doing vis-a-vis other private individuals. So an employer, Mozilla and Brendan Eich, seems to me very different than the government leaning on religious figures and saying that they want to subpoena their sermon, right? So we've always sort of made one cut at, infringement on free speech, and particularly when it's the government that is trying to police, religious ideas, right? I think that should be especially problematic to us. I think it's important on the other side of the ledger, though, when we're talking about private individuals, to recall that there are sort of issues running in both directions here, right? So just as, Brendan Eich might have been wrongfully forced out of Mozilla based on, a $1,000 gift years before, right, something that we might want that person to be able to do in their private capacity. There are just legions of stories where, a person's parent dies and then there's an obituary run that says that they have a same-sex partner and then they're being fired from their jobs, right? So what I admire about what the church seems to be doing is trying to think about how we literally marry those two kinds of issues or protections in both directions, right? Whether we call that protecting religious freedom when we're talking about Brendan Eich, or we call that protecting, lesbian and gays from discrimination, quote unquote, in the other direction. Both sets of people need to find a way to be able to live together in peace going forward in a world that's likely to have same-sex marriage across the nation, and where religious believers are likely to be asked in the public square, as Bill said, to sometimes assist those things despite their own deeply held religious beliefs. So that takes us to the line drawing question. But I think it's important to start by looking at there are these kinds of really awful things that are happening, but they're happening in both directions.
That is Robin Wilson, a law professor at the University of Illinois, director of the Program in Family Law and Policy. Bill Duncan is with us, the director of the Sutherland Institute's Center for Family and Society. And we have Cliff Roske here with us in the studio, law professor at the University of Utah, chairman of the Board of Equality Utah. We'll continue the conversation, get to some specifics as we go along. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the claim made last week by leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that the religious freedom rights of people who oppose same-sex marriage are being violated and threatened. The church announced its support for certain LGBT anti-discrimination laws in Utah, but Mormons want the same protections for themselves. So we're talking about, is religious freedom, in fact, at risk? What's at the heart of the church's statement, the conflicts here, but also we'll talk about the opportunities for compromise because there seem to be some. We have with us Cliff Roske, professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, William Duncan, director of the Center for Family Law and Society, part of the think tank Sutherland Institute, and joining us from Illinois is Robin Fretwell Wilson, a professor of law at the University of Illinois. All right, so I want to get to some specifics here. The question of what exactly the church and other religious groups are asking for, what do they want? Elder Jeffrey Holland was there at the news conference last week, and he got really specific about the rights that they were talking about. So I wanted to go through some of these and have you comment on them. He mentioned that churches ought to have the right to teach their beliefs from the pulpit and in church classrooms. To select their own leaders, to minister to their members, freely, to share their views openly in the public square, which we'll come back to, but to use church properties in accordance to their beliefs. Do any of those sound threatened right now, Cliff Roske?
Certainly not in Utah. Utah has the strongest religious exemptions for churches and other religious organizations of any state that I'm aware of. So under our state laws, not only are churches, temples, synagogues, mosques completely exempt from all of our anti-discrimination laws, but also any company that is owned or controlled by a church, such as BYU, the Deseret News, KSL, they're not just exempt from laws against religious discrimination, but all discrimination. So they're free to discriminate based on race, sex, disability, any sort of characteristic they please. So those are incredibly robust protections for religious organizations in Utah. It's hard to see how those could come under attack here.
Bill Duncan or Robin Wilson, you can jump in here. Are we in agreement so far that those seem to be already protected?
Well, this is Robin. Let me take a cut at that then. Certainly on the teach belief, that's absolutely protected. Nobody, no religious freedom scholar believes that anyone is going to have to, you know, change church doctrine, preach that from the pulpit. That's not going to happen. The Hosanna Tabor case, which is a recent 9-0 decision from the Supreme Court, would seem to suggest that there, what does say that there's a ministerial exception within the First Amendment, which would mean that at least with the selection of ministers and what those, you know, who should be counted as a minister or church leader, I don't see that anybody has the ability to force churches to do otherwise. And I can offer a perspective. I don't mean to conflict with Professor Roski at all, because he would obviously know Utah law better than me. But where the fight has been in the states that have voluntarily embraced same-sex marriage, so the 12 states and the District of Columbia, long before we had this sort of judicial juggernaut of decisions, those fights were basically around religious nonprofits, and in particular the kind of counseling programs that they would have, marriage retreats, their church space, and whether the space would could, using the state anti-discrimination law, potentially be forced to be open to celebrating or hosting the reception for a wedding that that group could not recognize because of their religious beliefs. That's where most of the fight was. So if Utah, in fact, has these robust protections, as I'm sure they do, then that would not be a fight for Utahns.
But William Duncan, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Professor Wilson. I think that's probably important part of the context here is that this statement has to do not only, of course, with the state of Utah, where you know many people will pay closer attention, but the national debate and so I think it's important to keep that context in mind that we're talking about conflicts in a variety of states and not only Utah.
And let me get to something again Elder Holland mentions. He's quite specific about. He mentions what I guess you could call institutional protections. He wants there to be laws that give church-owned businesses or entities the same latitude in employment standards and practices as the church itself. This sort of gets to, Professor Roski, what you were talking about, it seems like, earlier. But then here's the big question that comes up, and this is where it seems to get dicey. And I think this gets to what Professor Wilson was talking about. These are the kind of non-institutional protections that it looks like the church is asking for. Physicians who object to performing abortions or artificial insemination for lesbian couples or you know, gay couples in general, you know, not to be forced to go against their conscience. A pharmacist, should they have the right not to carry the morning after pill? I mean, these are specifics that Elder Holland talks about. Do you think that steps over a line here? Clifford Roski?
I think that's where we have to be so careful. I think it's important to understand, and Professor Wilson put this beautifully before, you know, this country was founded by religious pilgrims fleeing religious persecution. And that tradition of religious freedom is traditionally understood as freedom from government, from government intrusions on our religious practice. And we have, in the 60s, recognized that that's not quite enough. That if you could get fired by your employer or evicted from your home because of your religious beliefs, even though that's not the government, you still need those protections. That, too, is part of religious freedom. But when we start extending that to the employers and the landlords and the business owners, really then all of our freedoms come under attack because, as we know, in the 60s, racial discrimination was justified on religious grounds, famously. I know that's hard for some listeners to believe, but a court in 1955 said, Almighty God created the races black, white, and yellow and placed them on separate continents because he didn't want them to mix. A clear sort of biblical attempt to justify racism. If each one of us has the right to discriminate, in effect, based on our religious beliefs, then we each get to pick and choose which laws we follow, which patients we treat, which services we provide. And that's a very dangerous idea that really leads to a kind of a chaos.
William Duncan, what do you think about that argument? Is that crossing over a line here?
I don't think so. I think we have to make some distinctions, I don't hear churches asking for the ability to, or perhaps maybe more specifically, encouraging their members not to employ people who don't meet church standards. If that is, if they're just practicing a normal business that doesn't have any kind of religious overtones to it, and I don't think that they're asking for exemptions from the normal kinds of discrimination claims that we all would agree are appropriate. I think we're talking about something quite different when we're asking individuals to actually facilitate conduct that they find objectionable. Now, there may be some instances where religious beliefs I can't think of some off the top of my head, but religious beliefs go so far that that they can't be accommodated, and the church statement recognized that that's a possibility, but. It, certainly in a situation where a person could access drugs that might have the effect of causing an abortion or can access an abortion in some other setting or, something along those lines, it seems almost churlish to for the state to require that every person do that precise thing when you could very easily accommodate pluralism by allowing some people to step away from that those requests because it clearly violates their beliefs. And I think we should feel some level of discomfort from in making the comparison between asking someone to allow a restaurant or to allow anybody in the restaurant that's not causing problems, and then someone being asked to do something they consider a grave moral sin, specifically the example of taking an unborn child's life. And I don't think it's too much to ask for the law to make those kinds of distinctions, given how, one would be really quite a grave exaction on the individual believer and how the other really doesn't have that kind of effect.
Elder Holland said in the news conference that in many of these cases, there are physicians in communities who are willing to perform abortions or offer artificial insemination services for gay couples. There are pharmacy chains in most of these places that are willing to offer the morning after pill. So those unwilling, I guess, which gets at William Duncan, what you're after, should just sort of be left alone. And I guess, Robin Wilson, in many ways, that speaks to one of your points, this question of what constitutes hardship.
Well, that's right, Doug. And so let me back up for just a second and perhaps conflict with the elder on one point. We already have protections for abortion. In fact, we've had ironclad guarantees contemporaneous with Roe in 1973 that have flowed forward for 40 years that say no one will have to do an abortion under federal law that conflicts with their religious or moral beliefs. Also allows people who want to do abortions to do so without punishment from, let's say, a Catholic hospital where they would have their staff privileges. So it protected conscience in both directions. I think that's really important. That's a little bit like the Brendan Eich versus the, teacher who was, found out, oh my gosh, to have a same-sex partner, right? We need to be thinking about how can we protect people in both directions. We did that at the get-go with abortion. 47 states have pushed similar guarantees into their law. And so on abortion, there just is no question that doctors and nurses and others will be able to step off.
So what's he saying, though? So why is he mentioning that? In fact, there's already protection in hand. Why would you even cite that as an issue?
Well, then I think, in all fairness, I mean, I think these statements are made in good faith. I don't know, he may not be reading my articles. He should, obviously, right? But in any event, whether or not he has, people tend to start with abortion because they know that it has deep religious significance for many, many people, right? And to ask a person to hasten what they consider to be the end of a life is just a bridge too far, right? Americans can get behind that. Notice that this ironclad guarantee in law has gone nowhere, right, since 1973. It's stuck. And it's stuck because people believe that's a religious thing. But when you move from abortion out, that's how you get to your pharmacy cases, mm-hmm. right, and your morning after pills, because right. then this is a chemical that people believe is ending a life and being. And apparently the elder didn't read my articles about this either, because some of these pills, the quote-unquote morning after pill plan B, are not acting as abortifacients under anybody's definition, and we have 14 years of evidence, scientific evidence around that. Not so with Ella. Ella likely is acting to destroy the egg at the time it tries to implant. Many, many people would consider that an abortion. And even there, we have sort of a spotty effect of state laws, some of which will protect the pharmacist, some of which will protect the pharmacy from having to dispense these things, and some of which do nothing. But here's an opportunity to think hard about how we draw lines. Like, for example, I think the individual pharmacist, as I've said in my writing, who believes they're going to hell if they dispense, can frequently be staffed around at a Walgreens, you know. So if, let's say, Cliff is on the staff with me and Cliff doesn't have any problem handing out, you know, Ella, fine, I just look to Cliff and I say, hey, do you mind doing taking this patient? Patient doesn't even have to know about it if we correctly organize this scheme, right? But if we give an exemption to the pharmacy, right, then we really are threatening a lot of access. And we need to think hard about where we're going to locate exemptions or protections for religious believers so that we optimize the amount of access while trying to protect religious belief. So I think there's an opportunity to think about individual versus institutional. And it's interesting that what he's asking for were institutional protections. And the other reason I think that's interesting is, in effect, what he's asking for are the kinds of protections that we've seen in the voluntary same-sex marriage states, where almost all of the protections were down to the benefit of what I call big religion, i.e. religious nonprofits and churches, not so much the little guy, the individual pharmacist. And I think sometimes we get that wrong, both as an access question and as a religious freedom question.
So it's interesting. Do you have a sense, Cliff Roski, of why Elder Holland is making this particular argument? I mean, is he misreading the law, or is he just trying to make a larger case? He'd be forgiven for making it look worse than it might be to make what they see as a significant case. Do you have a sense of any of that?
As Professor Duncan said earlier, it's important to remember, and the Church did emphasize this at the beginning of its remarks, they have 15 million members worldwide, many countries around the world. And in most of those places, Mormons are a small minority faith. I think it's safe to assume that the remarks were not limited to Utah and may well not be very well applicable in a place like Utah or even in most of the United States. But I think it's really important to just pause for a moment and notice how far we are from the conversation about gay and transgender rights. We're talking about abortion. And the claim that the recognition of banning discrimination against gay and transgender people will threaten religious liberties depends on an analogy between abortion, being forced to perform an abortion, and being, quote, forced to give someone flowers or bake them a cake. Not a strong analogy, I think it's fair to say. And the big question here is, who will decide where to draw that line? Surely we can't ask the business owners themselves to draw the line. That's not fair. But do we really want judges deciding in individual cases, well, does your religion really require you to do this? How is that going to go?
So what do you do?
I think, you know, we find a way, which we've largely found, to protect everyone from discrimination based on religion, based on race, based on sex, and based on sexual orientation and gender identity. That's fairness and freedom for everyone. That's the most freedom we can get. Once we start giving employers more freedom than workers, then all of a sudden the balance is quite upset.
So you think what the Church said last week was reasonable but imbalanced in that view?
I think, as the Church said, they were announcing broad principles.
Okay.
They have committed themselves to the proposition that we can protect both values, and I agree with that.
Right.
And the question, of course, is in the details here. And I think you really hit upon the dangerous line to cross, which is telling individuals that based on their own definition of what their religion requires, they can have exemptions and pick and choose which laws to follow. That's scary stuff.
William Duncan, we need to head to a break, but I wanted to give you the final word before we do that. Did you want to respond to any of that?
Sure. Well, I think in our laws we've often had to rely on people's good faith expressions of religious belief. Our law, you know, asks does allow individuals to show evidence that they have a good faith religious belief in doing or not doing something, and that's very appropriate. I think it would be a mistake to suggest that Elder Holland was saying that these rights only belong to institutions. Clearly, institutions need to be protected, but I read the comment, and specifically those specific examples do have to do with individuals. And there are instances, at least one I'm aware of in the United States, where a nurse claimed, at least, that she was asked to participate in an abortion that as a condition of employment. And so it's not a made up issue. It's a real issue. And I think Professor Roski is right that clearly applies not only in the United States but outside. So I agree with everybody that we ought to be thinking about how to draw those lines. But to think that we've already hit it, I don't think that's the case. I don't think we've hit the sweet spot yet by any means.
William Duncan is with us, director of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society, Cliff Roski, law professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, and we have Professor Robin Wilson with us, law professor at the University of Illinois. We'll get to some of your comments when we get back from a break. Back in a moment, listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, talking about the news conference last week, leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced that they would be supporting certain LGBT anti-discrimination laws in Utah, but they also want the same protections for themselves. They're worried about religious freedom. We have with us Professor Cliff Roski, law professor at the University of Utah, Bill Duncan, director of the Sutherland Institute's Center for Family and Society, and Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson, who is a law professor at the University of Illinois. Let me get to a few questions. Zach sends this question. You're talking about individuals and institutions being different classes, but we've already blurred the lines between the two with cases like Citizens United and Hobby Lobby. How does that complicate it? Clifford Roski?
You know, I actually don't think it does so much. I think this is a real misnomer. A lot of folks are saying we need to protect not only religious institutions but individuals, and I think they're failing to see that we already do and that we have for 50 years now. The civil rights laws in this country protect individuals as employees, as renters of an apartment, home buyers, customers, even applying for credit. In all of those cases, no one can fire you because they think you're a sinner or a heretic that is based on religion. Those are powerful and important protections that we all agree upon, and they're protections for individuals. If you try to extend that, and it only seems like a bit further, right? But if you try to extend that a bit further to the employer, but then you destroy all the protections for the employee. If you give it to the landlord, then no one who's renting can have it. The point here is that we have to be careful not to give certain individuals in their capacities as an employer or a landlord or a business owner a, quote, freedom to discriminate, which is really the freedom to impose their own beliefs on other people. And I think we all agree that as far as religious freedom goes, it doesn't give you the right to harm someone else.
Let me read another question here. This comes from Ross. Anti-discrimination laws aren't just about individual rights. They're also about building and maintaining community in a diverse society. Ross writes, they've contributed to a reduction in the number of Americans who maintain religious objections to race mixing, women working outside the home, and the equal treatment of those of minority faiths. He says, if those with the religious objections were granted impunity in past anti-discrimination legislation, our society would be even more divided than it is today. So I guess his broad question, as he puts it, can we expect that writing religious exemptions into some of these anti-discrimination legislation or more religious exemptions into this legislation, will that do more to divide us? I'm wondering what you think about that. Professor Wilson, what do you think?
Well, these are great questions. I think writing religious exemptions into legislation has often made that legislation viable, and it allowed it to pass. So you can look at the experience with the 12 states that voluntarily embraced same-sex marriage and the District of Columbia, and you will see that even though there was, you know, squeaking over the line support for same-sex marriage, without the religious liberty exemptions in those laws, the laws would not have succeeded. So the close vote counts show that. In-depth interviews with legislators like Speaker of the House Michael Bush in Maryland, where he says, I know for a fact that the religious liberty exemptions mattered to the same-sex marriage bill being voluntarily embraced. You know, that's a place where I think we can see the utility of allowing people to live together in peace, finding ways for folks who are deeply divided about a moral good to continue together in the same society actually advances rights for both sides, right? It pulls civil rights legislation over the line. We did something like that, too, in fact, with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, where we were celebrating the 50th anniversary. And buried in that Civil Rights Act is an exemption for a fictional woman, Miss Murphy, who owned a boarding house. In effect, anybody who runs a boarding house that's owner-occupied with four rooms or less is not considered a public accommodation. That's an individual exemption, in some ways, like the ones that I think Professor Roski is suspect of. But it allowed people who were deeply divided about race to find ways to step off without that actually imperiling the legislation and its utility. So Walter Mondale on the floor of the Senate when this was replicated 4 years later in the Fair Housing Act, same kind of exemption, said it's better to have 95% of the loaf and cut off 5% than to have nothing. And it literally helped pull these laws across the finish line. So I think this doesn't have to be sort of a winner-take-all. What we do better to try to do is find a way for individuals that have very different visions of the good to continue to live together.
This is Professor Roski. I just want to clarify that I have no beef with Mrs. Murphy or her exemption. I think there's an important distinction here between exemptions based on size, which are commonplace in laws and have nothing to do with religion, and exemptions for individuals based on religion. So all Utah laws and federal civil rights laws recognize that, for example, in employment discrimination, if you have fewer than 15 employees, you're exempt. Housing, if you rent fewer than four units, you're exempt. Small businesses are often exempt from these laws. And religious institutions are exempt. The problem is to let the individual employer, landlord, or business owner say, this violates my personal religious beliefs, because that's the exemption that swallows the rule. Then there's nothing left of our civil rights laws.
Let me ask about one of the questions that you all seem to agree on is this idea that you can protect religious liberty and still protect LGBT rights. Professor Wilson, I wanted to get you, one of the things you've mentioned is Massachusetts is having some pretty good religious liberty exemptions. That are they a decent model for finding this kind of compromise we're looking for?
Well, I think so. I mean, we'd have to look at them. They may need to, the anti-discrimination law in Massachusetts, of course, was there in place before same-sex marriage was recognized. That is a state in which a judicial decision brought same-sex marriage to that population as opposed to the voluntary embrace of it by legislation. So the kinds of exemptions that you see in the voluntary states, for example, is a religiously affiliated educational institution that before same-sex marriage limits the married student housing to people in traditional marriages. So the Catholic student housing at a Catholic university, right, is that going to be addressed by some of those statutes? And I'd have to look more closely at them. I think they're a good starting point, but I do think that a world in which you have same-sex marriage may key up particular issues that are important to religious institutions and individuals as well.
Do you think some of that's going to change in the years after some kind of ruling by the Supreme Court, which is expected, I guess, this summer?
Well, that's a hard question. it's hard to know which way they are going to go.
Yeah.
But let's just assume they recognize marriage equality, which I think many people believe. If for no other reason, they're writing against the backdrop of, you know, hundreds of thousands of relationships and, you know, families raising children together, right? It's hard to believe that you're going to lock those families out of marriage, or that Kennedy is, right? I still think this issue doesn't go away. It gets teed up, right? And the thing that we're not focused on that I thought was really important from the last question is, you know, we have then the next wave of civil rights issues for the lesbian and gay community, not the least of which is whether they're going to have basic protections that we've been talking about today, from discrimination in housing and employment and public accommodations. And 29 states don't give that now. And I think the trick here is going to be not to have kind of a Roe v. Wade moment, right, where all of a sudden we have a greater backlash against a community because of this, you know, a recognition of marriage equality. And I think one way forward is to try to find exemptions. Now, a lot of the last little bit of discussion, we have said in many different ways that a religious liberty exemption allows you to, quote, pick and choose, or allows you to, quote, you know, decide which private law is going to apply to you. And there's some truth to that when it comes to something like RFRA, which was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act at heart of the Hobby Lobby decision that recently came down, because it, after the fact, will evaluate whether a government action, you know, was necessary, right? Was it necessary to write a piece of legislation in a particular way that burdened a particular religious belief? But that's not true with the kinds of exemptions that we're talking about in the state voluntary same-sex marriage laws. These things are not written like standards or tests. They're written like rules. They're black and white. They say things like this: if you have a religious adoption or social services agency and you don't accept any federal or state monies for it, then you can place with heterosexual traditional families if that's what your deal is. But if you accept state money, you don't. Now, that's not allowing people to pick and choose which law applies to them. That's writing a very specific, you know, box around a particular kind of conduct, religious foster care and adoption services agencies, and saying if you want to be in this box and be able to serve some families but not all families, then don't take state money. But if you don't want to be in that box, then fine, you're not in that box. You take state money, you play by state rules. That's a very clear rule that is not picking and choosing what laws apply to you. And it's not trusting judges either. That's written by the legislature.
Let me ask, I wanted to finally get to this question, aside from these particular examples that Elder Oaks mentioned. He also mentioned how people are being publicly intimidated, retaliated against, as I said, because, as he said, they raised their voice in the public square. And it gets to this, I think I wanted to end here. How can you protect people from the consequences of their beliefs and the things they say in the public square? I mean, it seems like you can't really. I mean, there are going to be people who are going, you know, you have a freedom to boycott, not choose particular businesses because you find what they think to be disagreeable. Is it possible to really protect people from that kind of thing? William Duncan, what do you think?
I think it is, but not necessarily through legal rules, right? And I think that of course, it's very appropriate for a church that teaches standards of conduct and ways of interacting with others, following example of Jesus Christ, would say we can work this out. And the answer is not necessarily by creating more legal rules, but by teaching tolerance and modeling to the degree we can tolerance of different positions without rancor. And I actually think this is not entirely unrelated to what Professor Wilson said, which I think was really important, that we can create boxes that allow people to live out their beliefs free from interference without, as Professor Roski suggested, if I understand correctly, that we have to allow them to pick and choose what laws that they follow. And you know, one simple way, I guess, in the same-sex marriage context, would be to say that you don't have to necessarily facilitate a same-sex marriage while you while you're acting in the public square. And Utah's specific, or pardon me, the church's specific statement that would allow for precisely that kind of arrangement. And I think we'd have to ask ourselves, what do we really gain by requiring a florist, whether we agree with that florist position or not, from participating in a same-sex wedding or a photographer or something like that?
Right.
I think we could we've got to be careful enough, and we've got to be good enough people, I think, in our country to figure out how to do that without doing what I think no one's really asking for, which is permission to mistreat others for reasons that really have no religion, have nothing to do with.
I'm going to jump in here because we're about running out of time. Cliff Roski wanted to give you some thoughts here. Go ahead.
I'm actually thrilled by the overlap in the agreement that I've noticed in this hour. It seems like it's important for all the listeners to know what Professor Wilson just said, which is in 29 states, gay and transgender people have to ask, am I going to be able to earn a living? Can I pay the rent? These are basic needs that everyone – no one should be asking these questions. We need these opportunities. But then when we talk about religious exemptions, the kind that we've been discussing are so narrow. But that's not what's happening in most states. In Mississippi last year and nearly in Arizona, we saw broad, sweeping religious exemption laws. And those would be the kind of laws that would allow individuals to pick and choose or to have judges deciding after the fact, well, you do need to follow this law, but you don't need to follow that law. This is dangerous stuff. This is not the kind of narrow exemptions of, related to marriage that Professor Wilson was describing.
Professor Wilson, about 30 seconds. You want to say some final thoughts here?
Well, I'm also pleased with the overlap, and I think that the way forward is to try to find, you know, basically a deal that benefits both sides with the kind of narrow exemptions that I'm describing, which would help religious believers to step off from, as Bill Duncan said, things that all of us agree are religious in nature, like facilitating a person's marriage, but doesn't give people a license to refuse lesbian and gays, you know, based on their sexual orientation. I think Professor Roski is right to worry about the way that the RFRA debates have unfolded. And I don't mean because I think the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts are bad. I only mean that many people who asked for those kinds of broad, open-ended protections said they needed them to stave off gay rights. And if you're asking for religious freedom to keep other people down, you should not expect to get it. But if you ask for narrow rules, I think we can all get behind that, and that's the way forward.
It's Robin Wilson, law professor at the University of Illinois, director of their program in family law and policy. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Bill Duncan, director of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society, joined us from KBYU in Provo. Bill Duncan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Cliff Roski, law professor at the University of Utah, chairman of the Board of Equality Utah. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Braden Child. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.